I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Amazon spends more on R&D than NASA. All manner of applications are run on Amazon's servers. And at any given moment, Amazon offers more than 600 million items for sale from more than a million sellers to more than 100 million American Amazon Prime members, drawn by convenience, selection, and prices. In his new book, the award-winning reporter and author Alec McGillis outlines the cost of that convenience to communities large and small, and workers who are contending with dramatic changes to the very nature of work. Today on Midday, Alec McGillis joins me to talk about his important new book, Fulfillment: Winning and Losing in One-Click America. First, the news. And good afternoon. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you're with us. My guest today is Alec McGillis, an award-winning reporter for ProPublica whose work has appeared in the New York Times Magazine, The New Yorker, and The Atlantic, among many other publications. He has written a book, which is out today, about Amazon and about the seismic shifts that it's caused not only in the American economy, but in American culture as well, since Jeff Bezos started his online bookstore in the summer of 1994. Bezos will step aside as chief executive this summer, but Amazon's dominance in the economy will remain unparalleled. It is an enormous marketplace that dwarfs its nearest competitor in online retail sales. Its servers hold the data for companies across the globe, including some of Amazon's fiercest rivals, and the ways it influences the health and well-being of communities, large and small, and the ways in which it has changed the very nature of work are myriad. Amazon's distribution system is massive. It has warehouses within 25 miles of nearly half of the U.S. population, including two in the Baltimore metro area, from which more than 6 billion packages are delivered every year. In his latest book, Alec McGillis takes us into those warehouses and the lives and communities of the people who work there. With assiduous reporting and powerful writing, he chronicles the enormous imprint of Amazon and its far-reaching effect on American society. The book is called Fulfillment: Winning and Losing in One-Click America. Alec McGillis joins us from his home here in Baltimore. Alec, welcome back, sir. Good to talk to you.
Thank you, Tom.
And congratulations on this book. It is revelatory, beautifully structured, beautifully written, poignant, infuriating, and quite outstanding in every way. So it's a really important book, and I hope it gets the attention that it deserves. It's ostensibly about Amazon, but it's much more than that. It's a chronicle of rural and urban divides, competition between cities, and the way that communities have been affected by Amazon's effect on the economy. What was your aspiration here? What did you hope to let readers know when they read your book?
You know, the book, Tom, really started not as a book about Amazon, actually, but a book about the growing gaps and disparities in our country. I've been traveling as a reporter around the country for, you know, years now, and have just been growing increasingly concerned and alarmed, really, by the regional disparities that I saw on display. When I was living in Washington, working at the Washington Post, I'd go out to the Midwest during the Great Recession, and I just see this incredible struggles out there, and these towns where people just were just feeling so deeply the sense that their places were declining, the places they lived and loved were slipping away. And then I would come back to Washington, and in Washington during the Great Recession was more prosperous than ever, and this, the disconnect between those two kinds of places I found just very upsetting. And the gaps have grown even wider in recent years. I started, you know, thinking a lot about it after I moved back to Baltimore 8 years ago, and that Baltimore-Washington divide that's been growing so much that we all feel so deeply when we move back and forth between these two cities just 40 miles apart. And so I wanted to write a book that captured that divide. And it was a divide that, of course, became all the more acute in its political impacts with the election of Donald Trump. It played a role in that upheaval. And I thought, how am I going to capture this? How am I going to capture this in a book? Because there's so many different ways you could come at it. And what I decided to do was to come at it through the frame of Amazon, to kind of use this company as a thread that takes you around the country. The book is not so much about Amazon itself, but about the country that falls within its lengthening shadow. It's about Amazon's America. The company works as a frame, both because it's so ubiquitous, so it's a very handy way to kind of take you around the country, but it's also an explanation, a cause for this growing inequality between winner-take-all cities and left-behind towns. And so it really worked at both those levels as a way of looking at what our country is becoming.
You report that in 2019, more than 70% of venture capital flowed to just three states, California, New York, and Massachusetts. So, you know, Amazon is a big part of the problem, but not the entire problem, perhaps. But Amazon really does, as you report, play an outsized role in this zero-sum sorting between, as you say, winner-take-all cities. And when there is a winner-take-all economy, it creates winner-take-all places. So there are places, communities, cities that are failing because of Amazon, and others which are at least ostensibly thriving, although the accoutrements to that thriving makes it a very expensive place for people to live in, like suburban Washington or Seattle. But explain what's at the root of how this how the effect of Amazon what the effect is of these cities that are failing versus the ones who are thriving.
In a very basic way, what's happening is that you have in all different sorts of sectors of the economy, you have business, money, prosperity, commerce that used to be spread much more broadly around the country, that is now kind of hoovered, sucked, drawn into only certain cities, certain parts of the country. Take my industry of the media, which of course has just been reeling from the transformation of our business. You used to have ad revenue that was spread all around the country among newspapers, among local radio, TV. Now, with the shift to online, to digital ad revenue being the main source of revenue, 60% of all digital ad revenue in the entire country is now controlled by two companies, Google and Facebook, and they are, of course, in the Bay Area, and that place has now become so hyper-prosperous that it is, you know, the number one exhibit of just a really kind of dystopian levels of inequality in the San Francisco Bay Area. Then you have retail. So retail... commerce, money, business, prosperity in that sector used to be spread all around the country, from mom and pop shops all the way up to regional department stores, and now a growing share of that huge sector of the economy is controlled by this one company that is based in Seattle, and you've seen Seattle just be utterly transformed from quite a sort of middle class kind of town into another just hyper prosperous place with a huge homelessness problem, huge housing affordability problem. The company Amazon then selected as its second headquarters town arguably the wealthiest city in the country, Washington, D.C., home to five of the 10 wealthiest counties in the country. And And you're making a very important point that this kind of sorting, this huge imbalance, this disparity is not good for either side. It's obviously not good for the cities and towns that are left behind, that deal with blight and abandonment and depopulation and despair, and everything that comes with that. It's also not good for the winner-take-all cities that have been dealing with this incredible affordability, housing affordability crisis, terrible traffic congestion, a horrible displacement of longtime residents of the sort you've seen in Washington, D.C., above all, where you've had some 20,000 black residents by one count driven out in just in the last 10 or 15 years. It's an imbalance that is simply not working out for any of us. And this book sets out to capture that disparity and just show how deeply unhealthy it is for the country.
Alec McGillis is my guest. His new book is called Fulfillment, Winning and Losing in One-Click America. It's Midday, and I'm Tom Hall. So, Alec, one of the points you make, which is really interesting, I hadn't thought about it before, was that the internet is supposed to make it so that we can live and work anywhere we want. But in fact, the opposite has happened. In the tech industry, these entrepreneurs quickly found that location mattered more to them and their success than ever. Talk about why Jeff Bezos chose Seattle to start his company, 26 years ago?
This was the key moment, right? I mean, this is the moment where he was going to decide where to put this company that he had this, you know, really kind of far-sighted idea for founding. And there were a couple of reasons he decided to put it in Seattle. He had no personal ties to Seattle. He was, you know, he grew up in various places around the country, including Albuquerque and Florida, Texas. But he decided to put the company in Seattle for a couple main reasons. One was taxes. Right from the start, Bezos understood that one way that Amazon was going to triumph and beat the competition was that it was going to have the tax advantage of selling online and not having to charge sales taxes, assess sales taxes to customers, and thereby, you know, get an instant advantage against brick and mortar competitor bookstores. But for that to work, he couldn't set up shop in California, which would be a natural place for him to go, to Silicon Valley, which is already at that point, you know, growing a big tech hub. If he went to California, he would have had to assess sales taxes on sales within California, which was, of course, the largest market in the country. So the solution was to go to a smaller state where having to assess sales tax in the smaller state would be less of a big deal because that was only going to affect a few of your customers. So he picks Washington State as that smaller state. But the other reason he picks Seattle is that Seattle is already home to Microsoft. And Microsoft, you know, had already been going for a good dozen years in Seattle by that point. And so you had and had kind of spawned a bunch of smaller tech companies around it. So you already have this pool of tech talent to draw on, to poach from, essentially, if you go to Seattle. And this is the key, you know, when it comes to our new economy, to this regional inequality. The internet was supposed to let us be anywhere, work from anywhere. But instead, there's something about the internet economy, the tech economy, that actually encourages agglomeration, encourages a rich get richer effect. Because the way that tech innovation happens is that it happens through proximity. It's you know, very much in the model of, you know, how innovations happened over the centuries. You know, why we talk about places like 19th century Scotland or Renaissance Italy, Renaissance Florence, having been these fonts of you know, great ideas and innovation, and because that's how cities work. We benefit from having, you know, other brilliant people around us to sort of share our ideas with and bounce things off of. Not to mention that it helps to be in places where there's money, to be around the venture capitalists, so you can actually make that pitch in the elevator at the cocktail party. And so that's how the tech economy has grown, and it's very different from what happened, you know, in our manufacturing economy of the past century or two, where once you had a given innovation, once you had something like, say, the discovery of a new steelmaking process, you could take that work anywhere that you had the raw materials and the basic labor force to do the work, and you know, the transportation connections and whatnot to get your product out. The tech economy is different. It encourages agglomeration. It encourages a winner-take-all effect. What's made it worse in the last few decades is that while that agglomeration was happening, we've also allowed a weakening of our antitrust laws, our enforcement of antitrust laws to prevent the growth of monopolies. So on top of the sort of natural innovation dynamics of urban agglomeration, we've had a devastating softening of our approach to antitrust, which has allowed the growth of these giants. And finally now, as this book is coming out, we're seeing finally a serious re-engagement with monopoly and antitrust and talk about what we're going to do about this problem.
Alec McGillis, his new book is terrific. It's called Fulfillment, Winning and Losing in One-Click America. We'll have more with Alec McGillis after a quick break. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Midday. Stay with us.
You're listening to your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, my guest will be Congressman John Sarbanes, who represents Maryland's 3rd District and whose signature piece of legislation, the For the People Act, also known as H.R. 1, is garnering renewed attention in light of Republican-controlled legislatures around the country who are proposing hundreds of bills aimed at limiting access to voting. Sarbanes' bill would expand voting rights and require states to make voting more accessible and convenient. His bill cleared the House a couple of weeks ago, and Congressman Sarbanes will join me tomorrow to talk about the prospects for Senate passage of H.R. 1 tomorrow on Midday. If you've just joined us today, my guest is Alec McGillis. We're talking about his latest book, Fulfillment, Winning and Losing in One-Click America. To join our conversation, we're at 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, and you can tweet us at @MiddayWYPR. So, Alec, one of the observations that you have concerns robots that fascinated me. You write a lot about workplace safety and the experience of workers in these massive Amazon warehouses and other places. We meet a number of them throughout the course of the book. And when you talk about robots, which is a thing that folks in manufacturing point to as a thing that could lead to the accelerated demise of manufacturing processes, you say that robots, it wasn't so much that they were replacing workers as it was making their own existence more robotic. That's really fascinating. Talk about how that's happening in these warehouses and other aspects of Amazon.
It's absolutely happening, and I should credit that observation, as I did in the book, to a former colleague of mine, Noam Shiver, who's a business reporter at the New York Times, and I came across that line in a piece he did a couple years ago, and it really nails it. I mean, one of the main changes in these warehouses in the last few years has been, and I encourage people to try to go to the warehouses if they can. Before the pandemic, the company started giving public tours of the warehouses, and I had been in one previously, but I took one of these tours with my younger son, and we went down and took the tour, and it was just incredible to be inside there. And afterward, we went to Pete's Grill to debrief, because we're not taking notes inside. We wanted to be unobtrusive and inconspicuous, but we debriefed about all the things we'd seen. And one of the things that just blew us away were the robots. What happens now in the warehouse is that it used to be that the pickers, one of the main forms of work in the warehouse are the quote pickers, who would have to go up and down the aisles, the corridors, looking for the various items. Their handheld device would tell them where to go find a given item, and they'd have to go walking up and down looking for it, pull it out. It was very, difficult work because it was just tons of walking. There was often the risk of being shocked actually by the drawers that the items were inside. Now what happens in most of the warehouses is that you have these extraordinary robots that were created by a Boston company that Amazon then quickly bought up, so that other rival competitors couldn't use these robots. But they basically, these robots are constantly moving around this huge part of the warehouse. They look like little sort of ottomans. They're these kind of low square robots that then have on top of them all these stacks of goods and in shelves, and they're constantly moving around. They manage not to crash into each other, and they bring the items to the picker. The picker's now standing in place and just has these robots bringing to him or her whatever is needed at that moment. And so that's just one example of how work that used to be involved a lot of walking, but there was also somewhat of a you were on your own looking for things. There was a little bit more of a kind of self-directedness or independence or kind of initiative or hunt to the work. And now that worker is instead standing there the entire shift and just pulling things out of drawers as they come to him or her. And basically what we're down to is very rudimentary, very monotonous work that is just complex enough that it can't yet be done by a robot. There's certain things that they're having trouble getting robots to teaching them how to do, reaching hold of things is tough, knowing, because things come in different shapes and sizes. And so we're down to this very rudimentary level of tasks that the robots cannot yet do, but that are themselves very robotic.
Let's talk a little bit about the way Amazon has, overwhelmingly taken over the online retail sector. I think you say that eBay has the second biggest market share of online retail sales, and they're just like in the single percentages, right? And Amazon is in the right 80 or 90 percentile. So it's not even close. This technique of theirs that's called flywheel of success. This is a Bezos innovation. How does that work?
The basic way it works is that it all has to do with drawing merchants to the site. That the real reason for this extraordinary growth at Amazon, the last 10 or 20 years, especially the last 10 years, has been the growth of third party merchants on the site. Originally, Amazon was selling on the site goods that it got from wholesalers. It was a store where instead of going to Target or Walmart or Sears to buy your item, you'd go to Amazon and buy it. But they were just getting the goods from the manufacturer, whoever that might be. What's happened especially in the last 10 years has been this extraordinary growth in third party merchants selling at Amazon. So this is basically people selling their own goods directly on the site without instead of going the traditional route, the traditional kind of wholesale route. And they are now, you have all these merchants who now feel the need to come sell at the site because the site got to a certain, the platform got to a point where there was so much traffic coming to it that you felt you felt like as a third party merchant that you had to come onto the site. And so you end up with just this kind of accelerating flywheel of more traffic, more goods coming on the site, which then brings more traffic. And it just accelerates and accelerates. But what's happened with these third party merchants and why, and I spent a whole chapter on this in the book is that as they've felt the pressure to come onto the site to sell, because basically they feel like if they're not selling there, then they're nowhere. That, you know, this is because everyone basically, it seems like everyone is now turning to Amazon for whatever they need. So you feel like you have to be on that platform. What happens is that Amazon brings you in as a third party merchant and then gradually ratchets up their cut. So initially you came in and you were maybe paying 12 or 15% to Amazon of all your proceeds on the site. And now it's gotten to the point where they just keep adding in more and more fees, more and more, for you. It's going to cost you even more if you want to advertise on the site, and you realize you're not only going to get sales if you advertise, they're going to charge you for the actual fulfillment service. They'll charge you more. They'll start ratcheting that up. They'll charge you a basic commission. I spent a whole chapter in the book focusing on one particular group of small businesses, namely office supply dealers in El Paso, basically kind of the Dunder Mifflins of El Paso. And there are these couple of very charismatic, likable small business owners down in El Paso who have their companies have 12, 15 employees. They make good business selling their office supplies to local businesses or local government or local school districts, and have been doing so for years. And suddenly Amazon came in and basically tried to get the local governments, school districts to buy from the Amazon marketplace instead, and try to sort of soft pedal and say, look, this isn't that big a deal because you, the local government, can still buy from your local business. You'll just be doing it on Amazon. What that leaves out, of course, is that Amazon will now be getting a large cut of those sales, and the local business will be getting less. I even managed to slip into a session, a closed door session in El Paso, where several pretty high level Amazon executives had come to town to make the pitch to these local office supply dealers to basically come on board or else.
Yeah, you quote the term that economists used called monopsony, the effect of having just one buyer for a good. And in one case, it's the good is the labor that's in a particular town. But when these RFPs go out for entire school systems, for example, when it comes to office supplies, Amazon is able to, get gigantic government contracts, gigantic contracts for entire school systems, entire states worth of school systems. I mean, they're so voracious and they're so big that, the family-owned Dunder Mifflins, as you say, just can't compete. The other thing, of course, that Amazon makes its money, as a matter of fact, they make more money at this than they do selling goods to retail customers, is this thing called AWS, which is Amazon Web Services. When Bezos steps down later this year, the guy who's been running the web services division, a guy named Andy Jassy, is going to take over and will succeed Bezos as the CEO of Amazon. Talk about how that service works. There's an enormous amount of internet traffic every day. At one point you quote, every single minute, there are 2.4 million searches on Google, 4.1 million YouTube videos being watched, and 47,000 photos being posted on Instagram. That's every single minute. And Amazon figured out how to be the central pin in that very complicated internet system.
That's right. It was back in the early in the first decade of the century, around 2003, 2004, the company made this incredibly foresightful, or you might just say serendipitous, move to create Amazon Web Services, which was basically a way for other companies to run their basically their whole sort of online operations, their tech operations through the cloud, no longer having to have their own infrastructure for their whole for their whole online operations, being able to put that in the cloud and not have to worry about it anymore. Amazon sees it was really kind of almost accidental the way that they kind of stumbled on this new line of business, but it proved to be just incredibly lucrative. This doesn't get talked about as as much as the retail side of things, but its success in the cloud is deeply connected to its retail success because the cloud AWS has been so lucrative, has been really bringing in the company's biggest profits in percentage terms, which has then in turn allowed it to essentially price lower on the retail side. One reason it's been able to grow so much on the retail side is that it's been able to essentially kind of underprice against competitors because it could rely on the cloud profits for so much of its margins. So the that it's just a very clear example of how having such a breadth of a breadth of reach for the company across all these different realms becomes a problem from a competitive standpoint. And that's something that a lot of the kind of antitrust experts are sort of now belatedly coming around to talking about just how it's not it used to be, the basic rule was just, well, as long as prices are low, as long as a company keeps prices low, they can't really be accused of having a monopoly. And that was the sort of thinking for several of the past decades, really kind of starting with it in the 70s and 80s under Reagan. But that's now shifted, and we're realizing that there's a kind of there's a distorting effect of the market, a kind of power play that companies can do end up bringing us deeply anti-competitive results, even if the prices seem to be low.
Yeah, you quote Mr. Bezos as saying that the potential for the cloud was boundless. He said that the addressable market in the cloud was trillions and trillions of dollars, and it really is quite extraordinary the foresight that it took. I mean, he had to develop this capability to run his own business because he had not only people buying things from his store, but he had all this data that he had to house and manage. He had people streaming videos through the Prime Video service, etc. And he decided to rent that to his competitors. So, Netflix has to rent space on the server at Amazon. So he's getting money from Netflix while he is developing the software and the tech capability that he himself is going to need for his own business. I mean, it's quite something.
It is, and it almost harkens back to the days of Rockefeller and that the great Gilded Age tycoons who, the key there and the what Rockefeller and his ilk were able to do were basically to control the platforms. And back then, the platforms were the railroads. So if you control the railroads, then you're also basically going to control the oil industry because you're if you're John Rockefeller and you basically control both the railroads and Standard Oil, it's incredibly difficult for the smaller oil producers, to bring their product to market because they're going to have to go on your railroads. And that's essentially what we're looking at now. And it'll just be very interesting to see if now, with a new administration coming in, there are some signs that Biden is taking this seriously. He's nominated for the Federal Trade Commission. Lina Khan, this who was as a young law student just a few years ago, wrote really the definitive article, sort of explaining how this new form of monopoly was happening. He's also brought in some other people too, who come with a similar perspective, and this really is one of the key questions facing us now in Washington. How serious is the administration and Congress, where you do have some potential in Congress for bipartisan agreement on this. They're both parties have members of both parties have shown reasons for, you know, shown concern and alarm about the tech giants. They're kind of coming with different motivations for that concern, but it's one of the few areas where you could see some real possible consensus in action.
Yeah, I think you're right, because as you say, both sides of the aisle have different reasons for railing against tech, but certainly railing against tech is very au courant these days. The book is called Fulfillment: Winning and Losing in One-Click America. It's just out today. My guest is its author, the award-winning journalist Alec McGillis. Alec McGillis will be speaking about the book tonight outdoors on the patio of the Ivy Bookshop in North Baltimore. And we'll have more on that event and more with Alec McGillis on the other side of a quick break. I'm Tom Hall. It's midday. Stay with us.
You're listening to your NPR News station, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is Alec McGillis. We're talking about his new book about Amazon, the world's largest online retailer and a company with tendrils that touch numerous aspects of American society, from employment and real estate to technological innovation and transportation. There are more than 100 million members of Amazon Prime in the United States. That's just the United States. Doesn't account for the Prime members in other countries. 3 years ago, Amazon topped $3 billion in sales in just one quarter during the holiday shopping season. McGillis reports that that same year, 2018, after Amazon announced that it would build a headquarters in Northern Virginia, the median price of a home in the D.C. suburbs shot past $600,000. That's five times the median price of a house here in Baltimore, which is less than 40 miles away. The book is called Fulfillment: Winning and Losing in One-Click America. So what's your take on Amazon? Is it an evil behemoth or an indispensable convenience? You can let us know what you think at 410-662-8780, our email midday at wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is at midday WYPR. Let's go to the phones to Karen, who's on the line from Baltimore. Welcome to Midday with Alec McGillis.
Yes, hi. It's funny, I just got a notice from the Ivy Bookstore, so I just registered, so weather permitting, I'll be there later. So I have a very kind of negative attitude about Amazon, but part of it is because I'm privileged, I'm upper middle class person, I'm single, I don't buy a lot of stuff, so I can afford to not buy stuff on Amazon. I buy my books, for instance, from the Ivy or from, you know, small bookstores. And I think part of what, you know, has kind of, I read a long profile, I think in the New Yorker 2 or 3 years ago, that kind of told me a lot of the things that this book is going to further explicate. But I'm also a nurse. I just retired last year, and I used to take the Metro home. I used to take the Metro work a lot because I was a Hopkins nurse. And I just remember I would get friendships with people, and there was this one lady who I would actually see her on the bus that was connecting the Metro to my apartment on Park Heights. And I would often see her on Sunday coming back from her job at the Fulfillment Center. And here I had this easy, like, little 20-minute commute. She had to take, like, a bus, a Metro, two more. I mean, she had to commute for, like, 3 hours each way to go make, I don't even know what she was making, $12 an hour. This was a few years ago. And I'm just thinking to myself, even then, this is like the modern-day equivalent to me of sweatshops. And just because I have mine doesn't mean that I don't care about my fellow Americans and my fellow human beings. But again, I'm in the privileged position that I can afford to buy things retail. And I know that many Americans are so desperate and so living on the edge of, you know, finances that they are going to order stuff from Amazon. So I'm just saying, yeah. I'm privileged, but I personally can choose not to support that. But I know it's very difficult for other people.
And Alec, having looked into this, and as you said, traveled the country for some years now, seeing what's going on in small communities, large communities, what's your take about what should happen, yes, what people can do?
Well, Karen makes, you know, a very good point here. A couple of very good points. First of all, on the question of the Amazon consumer, it is worth noting that that in general, Amazon's strongest, you know, the numbers show that Amazon's strongest demographic really is actually a more middle class, upper middle class demographic. Does incredibly good business, strong business in, you know, among the most highly educated, you know, well-off consumers in this country. That there was an amazing poll a couple years ago that showed that actually that Democrats, the most admired institution in the country among Democrats is Amazon, more than the press, more than higher education, more than labor unions. So that really is the Amazon demographic, and it's actually, of course, grown even more in this past year as we've been sort of sheltered in place and making so many of our purchases online. To the point where their sales have just gone absolutely through the roof. On the point of the transit, though, that's something I care a lot about. I actually took that commute once with an Amazon worker a couple years ago when the first warehouse opened on Browning Highway at the old GM plant there. And it took us forever to take the various buses to get back to his home in Park Heights. And it just, so much of the book actually tries to capture what has sort of happened for Baltimore workers at these warehouses at Browning Highway and down at Sparrows Point, where you had just not that long ago, you had people at the exact same locations making $30, $35 an hour, doing very difficult work, very often dangerous work, but work that they found much more meaningful, fulfilling, work with much more camaraderie and purpose and fellowship. Jobs that you stayed at for decades because you felt such a sense of belonging. And now, in those exact same locations, we now have these warehouses where workers are making $15 an hour in a much more sort of isolated existence, a much less sense of purpose and camaraderie. I was speaking to one former Beth Steele worker just the other day about this, and he said he still lives right near on Sparrows Point. And he noticed that how the workers now come tearing out of the warehouses at the end, the ones who have cars come tearing out at the end of their shifts and just go flying out of the Sparrows Point complex. So they're driving so fast that they've had to put these very large speed bumps in there. And they're just desperate to get out of there, desperate to get home, to make that, you know, that long drive back to the city. And whereas back in the day, of course, you know, workers would very often roll out of their shift with their fellow workers and, you know, roll into the diner or the bar or what have you, just this real sense of just being in this together, sense of community. And there's just this complete loss of that now. So I really commend you, Karen, for, you know, thinking about these things as you make these purchases. That's really what the book set out to do, is to show all of us what's behind the one click. All because right now it's so easy not to think about it and just to like pull back that curtain.
And you do write about the halcyon days of Beth Steele, but you know, not at all uncritically. I mean, there were all sorts of management abuses in the steel industry and all sorts of problems with those jobs. There was a racial divide that was, just horrible. So Amazon is advertising $15 an hour as, and it's true, as being twice the federal minimum wage, and they're already paying it, as Congress can't seem to get its arms around passing a federal minimum wage that meets that very low standard. We have an email from Blake, who slugs his email one-sided book. So let me have you respond to this. He says, I agree that the assembly line has been a problem since Henry Ford, but how much does Amazon donate to charity? How many jobs do they provide, and have they developed technology that's valuable to society? You have a whole chapter about charity and what Mr. Bezos has done in that regard. How do you respond to Blake's concerns?
Charity is a very, you know, it's a very important point, because we've gotten to the point now where we have such extraordinary wealth at the top that that were kind of left just hoping that these men, and they're pretty much all men, are going to give us back some of it. The just in the last year, the wealthiest 9 tech tycoons in this country saw their wealth increase by $360 billion. Just in the last year, $360 billion. Bezos himself saw his wealth grow by $58 billion. He actually has been among the sort of tech zillionaires, been remarkably actually parsimonious in his giving, and has only recently started to give at scale. His ex-wife Mackenzie has actually been, far more sort of conspicuously generous just in the last year since they broke up.
Including a very large donation to Morgan State University.
To Morgan State, exactly. Yeah. But even mm-hmm. if Bezos were to start giving on sort of a on the order of kind of a Rockefeller or Carnegie, the robber barons of old, it still leaves the question of whether this is how we want to sort of proceed as a society, to be sort of dependent on the whims of this or that zillionaire to decide what we're going to invest in, what we're going to spend money on. And I get into this in great depth in a chapter in the book that centers on a big fight in Seattle over how to deal with the homelessness problem in Seattle, where there was an attempt to basically implement a relatively small new tax on big companies like Amazon to pay for housing and homelessness. And it was Amazon managed to defeat it. And so the city was basically left just hoping that the company would kind of toss some money that way, out of goodwill. So do we really want, in a democratic society, do we want those kind of decisions being made by us, by the citizen, by the taxpayer, or do we want them just being made by this or that zillionaire?
Yeah, and in 2018, you write that 1 in 10 Amazon employees in Ohio were receiving food stamps, and that Amazon was one of the top employers of food stamp recipients in 5 different states. What's your take? We just have a couple minutes left on the efforts to unionize the warehouse down there in Bessemer, Alabama. What chances do you give that of succeeding, and what do you think that'll mean for the company?
It's such a huge fight, and it's so striking that it's happening now, just as fulfillment comes out. It'll be tough. I mean, it's really tough under our current laws, especially in a right to work state like Alabama, to organize. And Amazon, of course, is doing everything it can to dissuade workers there from voting for the union. But the stakes are enormous. If you think about what happened at a place like Sparrows Point, where you had Beth Steele, which was, as you note, in its early days, incredibly, we should not idealize it. It was incredibly difficult, dangerous work that was in the early 20th century, very low paid, really tough, crazy hours, crazy productivity expectations, no real say on the job for workers, but they managed to get the union in there. Over the 30s and the 40s and the 50s, it was such a tough fight, but they got the union, and it transformed the work, both in terms of the pay and benefits, but also just the sense of the clout, the say, having a sense of determination, self-determination on the job. And we've now kind of come back full circle at that exact same place, right at Sparrow's Point, with workers there again not making much, with no say.
If it succeeds, if this effort succeeds in Bessemer, Alabama, it could spread like wildfire.
Exactly.
Across the country. All right, Alec, that's all the time we have. The new book is called Fulfillment: Winning and Losing in One Click America. Thank you so much, and congratulations on this important book. Alec will be appearing tonight in person at the Ivy Bookshop in North Baltimore at 7 o'clock. This is not a virtual event. It'll take place in the Ivy's outdoor patio. It's a maiden voyage for the Ivy as they gradually ease back into live events. The pre-registration is filled, but folks will be allowed onto the grounds of the Ivy, where you'll be able to at least hear the conversation between Alec McGillis and Laura Wexler. And if seats on the patio become available, they'll, of course, let you have one. That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, Democratic Congressman John Sarbanes joins me with an update on the status of H.R. 1, his sweeping electoral reform bill that's getting all sorts of attention these days in light of Republican efforts in state houses around the country to restrict voting. So Representative Sarbanes' bill would supersede those efforts. We'll talk about it tomorrow on Midday. Hope you can join us. Have a great day.
You're tuned to your NPR News station. Member supported 88.1 WYPR.